You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Michael Rivero, the creator of the website whatreallyhappened.com. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Mike, I have seen your website over the years, and you have some great stuff up there. I want to get into great detail about the website, but before we do, for the benefit of listeners, can you tell them a little bit about who you are and then lead up to how you started the website, when you did it, and all that stuff?
Well, I'm a farm kid from New England, and basically I didn't set out to become a political commentator or peace activist or even a talk radio host. It kind of happened by accident, and it all goes back to when I was living in Southern California, specifically in North Hollywood, and I was working in the film industry. And just quite by accident, it was back in 1994, I was watching TV, and this photo came on that was leaked by the White House to Reuters, showing the hand of White House Deputy Counsel Vincent Foster next to the gun with which he supposedly had committed suicide. And because film fakery is what I was doing for a living back then, the instant I looked at the picture, I said, this is a staged shot. There are so many things wrong with this picture. There's no blood or blowback on the hand with which he supposedly put the gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. No blood on the gun. And I did a little digging, and I discovered within the FBI's own FD-302 documents an attempt to fake and manufacture testimony by Foster's widow that the dark blued steel gun that was found with the body was the gun that Foster had inherited from his father, except that that gun that Foster inherited was actually nickel-plated, or as the FBI described it, silver-colored. So like a law-abiding, loyal American, see something, say something, I took this evidence of deception and fraud and said, you know, we're looking at a murder made to look like a suicide, and I tried to report it to the police, to the FBI, and then to the corporate news media, because I lived just in the same neighborhood. NBC News was only a couple of blocks away, and my career inside Hollywood evaporated immediately. We were getting death threats. And since I all of a sudden had a lot of free time on my hand, I started digging a little bit more, and I started creating a subpage on what was at that time my self-promotional job website, showing all these things that were wrong with the Vincent Foster case. And ultimately, my wife and I had to leave Southern California, and it was just a really horrible situation and quite unbelievable. You know, we thought stuff like this had happened back in the 1960s with COINTELPRO, but certainly not today. We wound up going up to Washington State and living in the town where they filmed the TV series Twin Peaks, which was quite lovely. And I just continued looking at all these things that were going wrong with the government, TWA 800, which of course is back in the news again. And I started growing and growing the website, and I moved it over to its own identity, which at that time was called Rancho Runamucca, which is kind of an inside family joke. And then I got an opportunity to come to Hawaii to work on a film being produced by a Japanese film company, which didn't care if the White House had me on their special high interest targets list. And so we moved here to Hawaii, and I worked on the film, and I kept working on the website, and eventually became whatreallyhappened.com. And it's a huge resource with all kinds of hard information in there. And then, of course, a few years back, I got contacted about doing a talk radio show. And last year, I was in the middle of the series Off the Map, and I reached a point where there just wasn't enough Michael to go around, especially at my age. And I had to make a choice. I could either go on making movies and TV shows about saving the world, or I could go on and try and save the world. And I chose the latter course. And that sort of brings everybody up to date, I think.
Special High Interest
Targets List.
Targets List. What is the acronym for that? Let me see.
We're not allowed to say that on the air. The FCC our license.
Would they do that?
If you do it intentionally, yes. They just change the rules. If a caller into your show uses a bad, dirty word, they'll let it slide. But remember, even though as a nation we're dropping white hot flaming death on innocent children on the other side of the world, we're not allowed to use bad language to prove we are a just and moral people.
You know, I was thinking about something along those exact same lines today. Everything's the opposite of what it should be. So this high interest target list, tell us about that.
Well, that's just a joke I use to basically indicate that you're a person of interest to the United States government. Of course, these days, we all know everybody's a person of interest to the government, with the NSA spying on all of our phone calls, our emails. They've been hacking into the countries of Europe. They're basically looting the cloud at will. We're seeing more and more revelations come out because of Edward Snowden blowing the whistle coming out through The Guardian. And the reality is that everything the government is doing with all of this NSA spying, it is a complete, blatant violation of the Bill of Rights. It's a violation of the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizure. It's a violation of the Fifth Amendment that they can't take our property without just compensation because they're using our own computers and cell phones to spy on us. It's a violation of the First Amendment because they're targeting political dissidents who are out there criticizing the war policies of the United States government. It's a violation of the Ninth Amendment because the government is not supposed to be able to say we can limit your right to have privacy on computers because it's computers, even though you can have right to privacy on your postal mail. And of course, it's a violation of the Tenth Amendment because the government is assuming new power and authority that is not explicitly declared in the Constitution. So they're batting about 500 in terms of breaking their contract with America.
Yeah, and it seems more and more that they think less and less of the Constitution. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. About 3 months ago, we saw these trial balloon articles that came out in the New York Times and on MSNBC openly saying the time has come to get rid of the Constitution. It's old-fashioned. It's 200 years old. It's just getting in the way of the smooth, efficient operation of the federal government. And of course, we know that Nazi Germany was a very efficient government, but I don't think we want to basically emulate their form of governance.
In a lot of matters, I like to try to identify who the culprit is, who's the bad guy. And in this particular matter here with the Constitution and the lack of respect for the Constitution, who's the bad guy in this matter?
I don't think we can point the finger at any one person. We know that most of this NSA spying really cranked up under the Bush administration. We know it's all based on a system called Echelon, which goes all the way back to the 1980s. I think it's a systemic attitude problem within the government that they are not required to play by the rules, and just over long force of habit, they certainly seem to have come to an attitude that the general population of the United States is an asset, it's property, it's a herd, not deserving of any respect or rights. We have evolved to a state of tyranny, which in many ways mirrors that under King George III that led to the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution.
When did this happen when you discovered these anomalies with Vince Foster? What was that year?
That was 1994. It was about the actual murder of Vince Foster took place about 6 months after Clinton took office. And Vince Foster was one of the four top fundraisers for Bill Clinton who all met very suspicious deaths just as questions were being asked about all this untraceable cash that was pouring into the Clinton coffers, which now we know was coming in from the Iran-Contra gun and drug running affair that was operated out of MENA, Arkansas, while Clinton was governor there.
It's amazing how all these criminals are interconnected. When was it that you felt that it was time to leave Southern California?
Well, we left only a short while after that. First of all, I was persona non grata in Hollywood. My career was completely over, and we were getting harassment. I really don't want to go into the details about that, but we began to realize it was physically dangerous for us to stay in Southern California. So we told everybody we knew that we were moving down to Australia, threw everything that we had in a U-Haul truck, and drove up the coast until we found the town of North Bend, Washington, which is a beautiful little town, very wonderful people who sort of took us into their embrace and helped us get reestablished there. And for a while, I was only able to work outside the country, and it was just a really kind of a tough time. And then, of course, this chance to move to Hawaii and start working in feature films again came along, and I wound up being visual effects supervisor on Lost for four of the seasons there. I did the visual effects supervision on the pilot for Hawaii Five-0, moved over to Off the Map. But by that time, the radio show and the website had really grown to be taking over my life, and the obvious threat of escalation of this current war into something truly global was something that couldn't be ignored. And so I had to make a choice. What did I want to do with what remains of my life? And trying to head off this rush to World War III to save the U.S. economy, or at least distract from it, seemed like a good idea, because this is a repeating pattern. Every time this private central bank Ponzi scheme is on the verge of collapse, the U.S. government launches into a world war to get out of it. Crash of 1907, World War I. Crash of 1929, World War II. Crash of 2008, we've already invaded a dozen countries on two continents. Technically, it's already a world war.
Yeah, we're going to run out of countries to invade. Then what, right?
Well, we go back and reinvade Iraq because they're breaking free, and while seeing what's going on in Egypt, Libya looks like they're going to get rid of their brand new U.S.-imposed puppet regime. It's a lot like the fall of Rome, where as Rome's central military weakened following the loss of their legion in Germany, the provinces just started breaking away until finally there were no conquered lands to support the huge debt run up by the Roman central government, and it all started falling apart. The empire divided into east and west, and basically it was downhill from there. It's obvious to me the United States has already gone into a serious decline, and I see really a very possible, probable outcome that it's simply going to collapse the way the former Soviet Union did, and hopefully we can guide it to its final hospice without triggering those nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and I think a lot more people are expressing this same view. As a matter of fact, I heard two people saying almost the exact same thing over the past 2 days. So this is something I think a lot of people are thinking about, and I can't argue with anything you're saying, and I don't want to argue with anything you're saying. But I just want to touch briefly on this, because I know you don't want to spend too much time on that point. What was the first indication that you knew that your career was over in Hollywood? Like, what happened? First, something might have happened, you would have been like, wow, that was odd, but then how did you know for sure?
The first indication was I was actually in the middle of a project that I was working on at a company that shared the same building as CNN Hollywood. And I remember the first day that I went in there with this picture of the gun in the hand, and there was this little outdoor cafe that everybody sort of shared for lunch. And I remember very vividly some guys from CNN listening very closely as I went down this list of all the things that were wrong with this picture and why it had to be fake. That very night, we started getting harassing phone calls. 2 days later, I was fired from the middle of this project I was working on. The owner of the company said, well, we just need to cut costs. You know, we need to get rid of some people. And I was in charge of this project, and I found out later on, following my leaving, the guy they gave the project to just couldn't figure out how I was making it all work. And they ran something like 3 months past their original deliverable. And then after that, I mean, I literally, cases where I get a call to go over an interview on a job, I get up there and they'd say, we can't talk to you. And I had people I'd known for 10 years, didn't want to be seen with me. It was a very obvious blacklisting. And if you go back and you look at the 1960s COINTELPRO, there was a very infamous case regarding this actress, Jean Seberg, who was a very vocal supporter of the civil rights movement at a time when the White House wanted the civil rights movement to be demonized because they were bringing a lot of negative attention to the Vietnam draft. Jean Seberg, of course, was a major celebrity. People were listening to her, and the FBI concocted this plot. Jean Seberg was pregnant by her husband, who was a French diplomat, and the FBI leaked this bogus story through the LA Times that Jean Seberg had had an extramarital affair with one of the Black Panthers, and her baby was going to be part Black. And even though it was the 1960s, and the sexual revolution, and the summer of love, and the autumn of gonorrhea, interracial sex and babies, especially for a married white woman, was still considered taboo by the majority of the population. And her career was completely destroyed, and ultimately she committed suicide. The story, of course, was a complete hoax, and because her husband had been a French diplomat, threatened to turn it into an international scandal. For a very rare instance in his long career, the FBI had to admit what it had done publicly and apologize in this little 3-inch column buried in the back of the same LA Times that they used to launch the scam. This is how the FBI operates, and I encourage your listeners to go back and study the history of COINTELPRO, because the government is back to playing those same dirty tricks today.
Why do you think it is that they took that kind of approach? I mean, you were simply just questioning this.
Tradition, mostly, I suppose.
No, really. Couldn't they have just ignored you?
No. The internet was just taking off. It was even before web browsers were really coming into the fore, and it was Usenet, and the government was very afraid of it because the internet was never intended to be a publicly accessible utility. It began as the ARPANET, and it was only intended for trusted military contractors, university research departments, and the government itself. And as it started to break into the wild, the government realized that here was a mass communication medium they did not have under their complete control. And so as all of the inconsistencies in the Foster murder began to surface, along with all of the growing awareness that Iran-Contra basically had come down to government-sanctioned drug and gun running, the government was taking a very heavy-handed approach, and they were using the tactics against the early bloggers like they'd used against Jean Seberg, figuring, well, they'll just go away and they'll kill themselves, or at least they'll shut up and never talk again. And of course, that is not what happened because of this internet and the blogosphere. And as I said before, because I suddenly had a huge amount of time on my hands, I kept digging and posting, and the readership of the website kept growing. People were taking articles, reposting them all over, and that's how we basically wound up where we are today. We've got a readership in the millions. I don't know what our radio audience is because we're not on Arbitron, although that may be changing very shortly. I do know my articles get picked up and republished. There's a radio show I did a while back called All Wars Are Bankers' Wars. Somebody actually took that soundtrack, made a video around it. That's gone viral all over the place. In fact, I just got a big stack of DVDs from the Dollar DVD Project that have that video on there, All Wars Are Bankers' Wars. And so it really took off, and a lot of people were writing me and saying, for the first time, the history of the United States now makes sense. They see a thread of continuity behind all these wars and assassinations that are going on that all leads back to the private central bankers wishing to keep the world enslaved to this model of having to borrow the public currency at interest from a private bank instead of the model the United States was started with, which was the public currency as a public utility that flowed through commerce without accruing interest to a privately owned bank.
and they'll do whatever they have to do to make sure they don't lose that.
They have gladly sent hundreds of millions of human beings to death and disfigurement over the last century to preserve their little banking scam. Iraq is a good example. 2002, Saddam Hussein gets permission from the United Nations to sell his oil for the euro instead of the dollar. 1 year later, we invade, lynch Saddam Hussein. Iraq's oil is on the world market only for the U.S. dollar. Libya is another example. 2 years ago, Gaddafi was everybody's good buddy, reformed terrorist, acknowledged Israel's right to exist, doing these huge infrastructure projects in Libya that was improving the quality of life for the Libyan people. Then all of a sudden, he announces they're going to have a state central bank and a value-based currency, the gold dinar. And if you want to buy Libya's oil, you will pay for it with the gold dinar. Boom, invade Libya, kill Gaddafi, destroy their state bank, install a brand new private central bank, get rid of the gold dinar, Libya's oil back on the world market, but only for the U.S. dollar. And by the way, apparently inspired by Egypt, the Libyans are now starting to make noises about kicking out their U.S.-controlled puppet regime.
Yeah, you had mentioned that before. Just getting back again to that office that you're at with the CNN folks, what you're saying is that the CNN office there, or at least the mainstream media and the government, are pretty much one and the same.
They very, very much are. At the end of World War II, the U.S. government was looking at Nazi Germany and said, what did they do that really worked for them that we can copy here? We all know about Operation Paperclip, where the beginnings of America's rocketry and space program were taken from Germany, brought to the United States. Ampex was given the technology for reel-to-reel tape recording as a spoil of war. MK Ultra was actually based on a German mind control program. That's why the initials are MK and not MC. And along with it, of course, they studied very carefully Adolf Hitler's use of media to propagandize the public. So the CIA began what was called Operation Mockingbird, in which they said, we've got to have CIA assets in charge of the corporate media. The FBI, through COINTELPRO, was constantly spying on corporate media. Anybody who was in the film studios that was writing a script that didn't toe the government line, there would be gentle suggestions they change the script or their funding would disappear. And it was omnipresent. I ran into these guys when I was working at CBS Television City. The CIA actually tried to recruit me. And, you know, I just got this incredibly bad feeling from these guys, you know, basically mafioso wrapped in an American flag. And so I politely declined. We knew what was going on all over the studio system when Oliver Stone was getting ready to do his film JFK. Somehow, an early version of the script vanished from his production office and was given to the media so they could start attacking that even before the film had been made. Oh, Oliver Stone is impugning the honor of the government by suggesting that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill John F. Kennedy. Again, we see it now. 2 weeks ago, we had some of the inside investigators into TWA 800 blew the whistle, saying they had been ordered to lie by the government about the cause of the crash of that 747 off of Long Island. And today, of course, the government's coming out with their own press conference. Oh, pay no attention to those whistleblowers. We spent all kinds of taxpayer money to prove that it was, you know, this. And all those people who saw a missile hit the plane, they were just drunk, so you shouldn't pay attention to them anyway. So this government doesn't know how to tell the truth. And because this government relies on the blind trust and faith of the population, they can't stop lying. They can't start telling the truth. They carry the accumulated burden of 100 years of government deceptions, whether it's torpedoes in the Gulf of Tonkin, Spanish mines in Havana Harbor, 9/11, TWA 800, assassination of John F. Kennedy, on and Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. And they can't ever admit they lied to the American people, because then the American people are going to say, well, you've been lying all the time. Of course, the American people are now aware of that in general anyway. It's a whole new world. The internet and the blogosphere have fundamentally altered the way information flows through society, just as dramatically as when Gutenberg rediscovered movable type printing. And those institutions that are able to evolve and adapt to the new reality will survive. And those institutions that can't evolve to the new reality are doomed to go extinct. And I count the United States government in that latter category because of that accumulated history of cover-ups and lies that they are burdened with maintaining.
Mike, are you a little surprised that even with this amazing tool, the internet that we have, which was really just released, I think, for commercial use in 1992, I think it was created in 69, with this wonderful tool we have, there still are a huge number of Americans who believe that Building 7 collapsed from one fire in an office. Are you surprised that more people have not woken up yet?
Well, my perception and my understanding, certainly from the people that I talk to, as I go around my daily life, I make a point of talking to people to sort of take reading of the public mood. If there's a majority opinion on World Trade Center 7, it's the majority that don't even realize it came down, which, of course, is the whole issue behind the new campaign by Artisan Engineers for 9/11 Truth, where they're going to be mounting billboards all over the country to say, you know, there was a third building that came down and the government can't explain how it happened. But the number of people who actually are buying the official story on 9/11 in any way, shape, or form appears to me to be a tiny and shrinking minority. And most people, when they see that video of Building 7 coming down, they're saying, of course it's controlled demolition. There's no other way you could see that building just plop down into its own footprint. And no, the fires were not sufficient to bring it down, especially when you remember that Building 7, the Solomon Brothers building, was built to house government offices. And so it was built much more fireproofed, much more bombproof, much stronger and more rigid than the regular standard building code that was followed for the two big towers and the other surrounding buildings. So this was a building that was designed to not succumb to fire or even bombings and a couple of office fires, and it just comes crashing on down. Nobody's buying that one.
Again, I hope you're right, Mike. How big of a part, because anyone who digs into this stuff that you're talking about always comes across the fact that Israel and or Jews, Israeli Jews, U.S. Jews are kind of the puppet masters. They're behind the scenes. They're always there when things are happening. How big of a part do they play in this ugly world that we're living in now, led by this ugly government?
Well, there is absolutely no question that the government of Israel wields a disproportional influence over the United States government through AIPAC, which hands out huge amounts of campaign contributions to members of Congress who will support Israel's agenda. AIPAC has been caught in its own spying scandal. We know that on 9/11, the only people actually arrested near the collapse of the World Trade Towers turned out to be Israeli. Three were identified by National Public Radio as agents of the Mossad. We know that Israel has a long history of using false flag attacks to trick people into supporting their policy. The most famous, of course, is the Levant Affair. This took place back in Egypt, where Israeli agents were bombing British and American assets and planting evidence to frame Egyptian Muslims. Fortunately, one of the bombs went off prematurely. They caught the bomber. It was exposed as an Israeli operation. The government of Israel says, ah, yeah, being anti-Semites, saying we had anything to do with it. And then ultimately they say, all right, you caught us. We did it. Another very infamous false flag by Israel was the attack on the USS Liberty, where Israeli boats and planes tried to sink the ship, even as the government of Israel was telling the government of the United States, oh, you're being attacked by the Egyptians. Go bomb them. Go bomb them. And apparently there was a nuclear armed strike in the air on the way to Cairo when the crew of the USS Liberty were finally able to get a radio message out to nearby American ships saying these are Israelis shooting at us. And Johnson was forced to recall the strike against Cairo and then say, oh, we can't embarrass our friend in the Middle East, Israel. It was foggy. It was cloudy. It was mistaken identity, which, of course, is nonsense if you talk to any of the survivors who were on the ship that day.
Besides these few matters that you brought up and the false flags, is there something inherent in not just Israel, but Jews that would have them in these positions where turmoil is being created?
I really, really want to draw a very thick line between the actions of the government of Israel and their agents in place versus a general brush about Jewish people, because that just plays into Israel's propaganda theme that opposition to Israel's government represents anti-Semitism. And that, of course, is nonsense. We're not talking about anybody's race. We're not talking about anybody's ethnicity. We're talking about the actions of a government that are highly, highly questionable. Yes, there are a lot of people inside our government who are supporters of Israel for political reasons, not religious or ethnic. There's a huge volume of cash that's flowing around, and people are greedy. And there are those within our government who will sell out to a foreign government with a lot of money without necessarily being a particular ethnic or religious group. And so we really do need to keep that line. Remember, there was that wonderful interview by a former member of the Knesset over at Democracy Now! And this lady was saying, Israel uses this as a trick. If anybody's criticizing the government of Israel or asking questions that there are no answers for, the first thing they scream is anti-Semite, anti-Semite, anti-Semite. And so we need to keep that big black line between government of Israel and anybody else in order to deny them that particular propaganda tool.
You're just talking about the government of Israel.
I'm talking about the government of Israel because ordinary people, even the people of Israel, are not happy with their government right now. So the world's Jewish people are no more responsible for the actions of the government of Israel than the world's Muslim people are responsible for the actions of Al-Qaeda, whoever that actually turns out to be, any more than the people of the United States of America are responsible for the actions of the NSA, CIA, FBI, and the drone strikes. The world knows the American people don't support these policies.
Right, but Israel plays a big part in the misery that we're experiencing now.
There is no question about that, and it is a major problem. I remember when I was in grade school, and we were seeing all these film strips about beware of communist subversion. The communists are coming to subvert our government. And it turned out our government was being subverted, but we were looking in the wrong location. And again, go back and do a web search for AIPAC spy scandal and all these situations, ADL. It's basically we do have a subversive movement in the United States subverting the U.S. government to the purpose of a foreign government. We should be very much alarmed by that.
Have you been accused by groups or individuals of being anti-Semitic?
Yeah, every third day, I am a proud member of the Southern Poverty Law Center's list of websites you should never, ever, ever look at or your nose will drop off. But, you know, it's kind of a joke here, you know, to be calling me anti-Semitic because I don't talk about the Jewish faith. I don't talk about the ethnicity. I'm talking about actions of a government. And you need to remember, Rivero is a Sephardic name. My family was Jewish up until the 1490s and the Spanish Inquisition, you know, basically tortured my ancestors into converting to Catholicism. So if it wasn't for the Inquisition, I would have probably been a rich Hollywood Jew myself today. So this idea, oh, he's an anti-Semite. Basically, they're trying to blur what the word means. Anti-Semite means a blind hatred of people just for being Semitic, which not only includes Hebrews, it includes Arabs. And Israel's spin is anti-Semitism is opposition to the policies of Israel's government. And that's nonsense. That's like trying to deflect criticism of Nazi Germany by screaming, you're anti-German. You're anti-Aryan. Hitler didn't do anything wrong. You just hate the German people. We correctly laugh at such an absurd notion, and yet Israel has gotten away with this same propaganda dodge for 60 years.
But it works, Mike.
It doesn't work anymore. The good news is they've burned out the shock value of the word anti-Semite, and it doesn't work anymore. They say, you're an anti-Semite. Who cares anymore? Mm-hmm. And most Americans realize that anti-Semite isn't somebody who hates Jews. An anti-Semite is somebody that Israel hates.
Exactly. It just bounced right back to him. And just one final thing, Mike. Is this what we're talking about here, Israel's involvement here and all this stuff? Is that the biggest problem the United States faces today?
Absolutely not. The biggest problem the United States faces, and the biggest problem the world faces, is this fraud of a banking scheme called private central banking. And given that tomorrow is Independence Day, I want to point out the history that what really drove this country to a revolution against Britain was King George III's Currency Act, which said you cannot have your own monetary system. You must conduct all commerce only using banknotes, borrowed interest from the Bank of England. And after just a couple of years, this little predatory banking scam reduced the colonies down to abject poverty. And the rage from that is really what fueled the popular support for the American Revolution. So this nation was started up with what was then a very radical idea. The public currency should be a public utility issued by the government interest-free to flow through society, fueling commerce, taxed back at the end of the cycle to balance the books without this constant skimming off of part of the work product of America for these private bankers. Unfortunately, the private bankers are relentless. They came in and succeeded in tricking, bribing the U.S. government into creating the first Bank of the United States, which had a 20-year charter. At the end of the 20 years, the American people were living in poverty, and Congress said, we will not renew the charter. We have seen what you bankers have done. And the head of the Rothschild banking cartel literally issued a public threat against the United States. If you do not renew the charter for our bank, you will find yourself in a most disastrous war. Congress stood firm, and the next year, Great Britain, which was offered virtually interest-free financing for a war of conquest to recolonize America, launched the War of 1812. Even though the United States won the War of 1812, it so impoverished the nation, they were forced to accept a second Bank of the United States for another 20-year charter. And at the end of that 20 years, once again, the bankers were insanely rich, the American people were driven down into poverty, and that led to Andrew Jackson running his campaign for a second term on the slogan, Jackson and no bank. And he's famous for that quote, "I've had gentlemen watching you. You are a den of vipers and thieves, and I will rout you out." And Jackson did succeed in ending the charter for the Second Bank of the United States, whereupon there was almost immediately an attempted assassination on his life, which failed when both pistols failed to fire. And they captured the assassin, and he was saying, "With Jackson dead, there'll be more money in circulation because we'll go back to the private bank just handing it out there." We have this private central banking and the private bankers trying to dominate the economy, and it's tangled in with Lincoln's assassination, Kennedy's assassination, getting into World War II. And I would recommend everybody go out and find my little article video on "All Wars Are Bankers' Wars," and it just lays it out how all of history is under the control of these private central bankers trying to keep us enslaved to their little debt machine. And I'll tell you how the trap works. When you have a private central bank issuing the public currency as a loan at interest, the instant that first paper note goes into circulation, more money is owed to that private bank than actually exists. And over time, it just gets worse and worse and worse, no matter what the Federal Reserve does, no matter what the European Central Bank does to try and keep this little pyramid scheme going along. The aggregate total debt grows faster than the aggregate total money supply. It is impossible to ever repay all that debt, and that debt is used to control nations. It's used to control individuals. In fact, there was this wonderful movie called The International, where there's this wonderful quote in the movie saying, "The very essence of the banking industry is to keep us all, whether we are nations or individuals, slaves to debt." And that is what it is. It's enslavement. It's rule by artificially created debt. And it's no more legitimate a form of government than rule by divine right or rule by chattel ownership of your person. The only legitimate form of governance is self-governance. That's what the founding fathers tried to start in this country 200 some odd years ago. The bankers can't stand that. They can't stand state government issued currency, and they will provably, historically, do whatever it takes, up to and including world wars, to keep the world enslaved to their ink and paper. And the good news is, though, it looks like the whole system is about to come down. And because of globalism, it's all going to come crashing down at the same time. And so as we sit here and we think about the blueprint for the new America, the very topmost concern we should have up there is no private central banks. And we restart the world, we restart society, we restart our country back with the model of the public currency as a public utility, and break free of a century of enslavement to this private central banking fraud.
People not familiar with your website, because this interview is going to be introduced to people who might not be. So Tell the listeners a little bit about the website, because there is a lot on the website, but what's available on the website?
Well, the website is called whatreallyhappened.com. There is at the top a small permanent index of important articles that you might want to look through, but the majority of the main page, at least, is a constantly updated series of links to important stories with commentary in terms of de-spinning what you're being told, in terms of current events, the Zimmerman trial, what's going on in Egypt, all of the various gates that are engulfing the federal government right now, the NSA spying. We've put up links to cryptographic tools for those of you who want to keep your communications private from a government with a proven history of stealing information from the American people, law-abiding American people, and using it for their own personal gain. So we have helpful hints about that. And we have a membership that also posts their stories and their commentaries as well. And it's a constantly changing experience, so you do want to come back to it on a pretty much daily or every other day basis.
I know from visiting your site quite often, it is on the cutting edge. Michael Rivero of whatreallyhappened.com, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to listeners. Folks, check out whatreallyhappened.com. Mike, thanks so much. Have a great 4th, and hope to talk to you soon.
I look forward to it.